Gentlemen, welcome to this evening's Vancouver Institute lecture. Our speaker tonight is Miss Pat Kearney. Miss Kearney received her bachelor's degree at the University of British Columbia in political science and economics, and for some 15 years she was a journalist in the field of economics. She has developed an interest in the North, both in terms of its economy and its social structure and its communication problems. At the present time, she is president and chief executive officer of Gemini North, and she is also project manager for the Distance Education Planning Group of the Provincial Department of Education. And I would like to assure you that when we planned the program for the spring, we had no idea of how timely this topic would turn out to be. This evening, she will address us on the space age classroom, satellite tele-education. Ms. Kearney.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I warned our chairman that my talk tonight was 58 minutes long with the video insets, and that he said that he could give the shortest introduction in the history of the Vancouver Institute, and I think he did very well on that. On October the 25th, 1977, education in British Columbia took a major step into the space age. On that date, the Ministry of Education's satellite tele-education program initiated an 8-week experiment in interactive television utilizing Hermes, Canada's innovative communication technology satellite. Only after we began the project did we discover that, mostly in innocence and certainly in ignorance, we were conducting a world-class experiment. Hermes is the most powerful domestic satellite in orbit. And among the 26 Canadian experimenters, the British Columbia project was unique in terms of the range of participating agencies, programming formats, and delivery systems used. And tonight we hope to share part of our experiment with you. We thought it would be appropriate to augment my face-to-face lecture with some video support in a sort of a satellite show and tell. And in the back, George Coleman and Art Beck are at the controls. Before switching to tape, however, there are a few things that you need to know about satellites. First, the communication satellite field is a very dynamic growth industry. There are now some 65 communication satellite systems planned or in operation. These systems range from the giant Intelsat system, which now serves 90 countries, to small domestic systems, which cost about $250,000 annually to operate. Countries involved in this form of communications technology range from Algeria to Zaire, so we're not alone. And as you know, Canada is a world leader in this field and initiated the world's second separate domestic satellite system in 1973 with Anik A. These satellites provide a proliferating range of services, from the remote publishing of the Wall Street Journal to military and public telecommunications, television broadcast services, data transmission, even communication with offshore drilling rigs. In 1979, IBM and partners will initiate the Satellite Business System, which will allow customers to own and operate their own earth stations at their business locations. In Canada, restrictions on the ownership of earth stations are presently under review by the Federal Department of Communication. Interest in this form of communication is rapidly increasing as the costs decline and the technology becomes more manageable. Earlier satellite systems required large ground receive stations, such as the type used with Anik A. These are correspondingly costly. In addition, these older systems operate at relatively low frequencies, which are already crowded, and it is difficult to position them in urban centers because of the noise levels. But Hermes is demonstrating the feasibility of high-powered television transmission in higher frequencies, which are reserved specifically for satellite transmissions, and which require much smaller Earth stations, up to 1/10 the size of those used with conventional satellites. On Hermes, we were using Earth stations which were 1 meter or 3 meters in diameter, compared to 30 for the larger system. So Hermes is viewed as the forerunner of direct-to-home and direct-to-community broadcasting services. In the future, possibly within the decade, the home received station will be as common as today's microwave oven. And skeptics of this mushrooming technology might do well to remember that even in the 1950s, some forecasters could foresee no markets for computers, and the role of rockets and space flights was still being dismissed by some as unrealistic science fiction. BC's participation in satellite communications reflects the Ministry of Education's initiatives in the field of distance education, or the delivery of educational opportunities to people who are separated by geographical or social barriers from traditional education institutions. It should be stressed that the satellite tele-education program is only a part, and a very small part, of this initiative. This week, the minister, Dr. Pat McGeer, announced that BC has signed a letter of intent with Britain's Open University to explore ways of utilizing that institution's programs and methods here in BC. The Open University offers university credit courses to people through print, radio, television, a network of local study centers, and I believe a summer school. Next month, the ministry, in cooperation with what I still call Manpower, but is now called Canada Employment and Immigration Commission, the BC Institute of Technology, and the province newspaper, will launch an experimental non-credit course in career planning and job search offered through the daily newspaper. So this is just one in the mix of techniques that we're experimenting with. I suggest that we turn to our television monitors to hear Premier Bennett explain BC's interest in satellite technology and for some information about Hermes itself.
There are several reasons why I believe STEP represents an important idea and a technology whose idea has come. British Columbia has a rugged geography and a widely scattered population. In an age when education has never been more important, more than 1/4 of its adult population has not gone beyond grade 8. The STEP program will explore whether tele-education delivered by satellite can help to overcome these geographical and social obstacles. The satellite's powerful signals can be transmitted to portable ground stations in the most inaccessible areas of British Columbia. Even more important, its interactive component permits a dialogue between student and teacher who are separated by long distances. Rather than building costly institutions or expecting the student to travel long distances, we want to find out whether learning by satellite can take place in the community hall or in the living room.
Earlier, I mentioned that the BC experiment was unique in terms of the range of delivery systems used. We used not only the satellite, but we used community cable systems and landlines, college classrooms, and even radio telephone. Our production and transmitter facilities were located at the Provincial Educational Media Center studios in Burnaby under the direction of my colleague, Jean Lawrence. Now I'll stop there because, George, I realize I never gave you time to punch up Hermes. So can you do that now?
We've been transmitting television point to point by satellite in Canada for years. We got into the business of using satellites for domestic communications before anybody else in the world. We got into it because the country is so big with so many empty spaces between the places people live. If you want to move an electronic signal over a long distance, satellites are the best, and in the long run, probably the cheapest way to do it. For telephone conversation, computer data transmission, and telex, radio and television signals. Before the satellites, we had three choices: wire, microwave, or shortwave. The FM signals of microwave go only to the horizon and then have to be passed on by an expensive network of relay towers. Shortwave is bounced off the ionosphere, the invisible mantle of electronically charged cosmic particles above the stratosphere. The problem with shortwave in our part of the world is interference from the northern lights and other disturbances of the ionosphere. The pursuit of better communications was in satellites. A satellite is like an FM relay station, so high up that it can throw its signal over an immense distance before it reaches its horizon limit. We put up our first domestic communication satellite, the first ANIC, in 1972. There have been two more since then. And we were the first country to have a geostationary satellite for our own communications uses. A geostationary satellite travels through space in an orbit over the equator at a speed exactly equal to the rotation of the Earth below, so that it's always in the same position in relation to the Earth. Coverage of the ANIC signal is practically nationwide. The coverage area of the CTS, its footprint as it's called, is about the size and shape of one of these figures. The shape varies according to how CTS sees the Earth from its orbit, which is about 22,000 miles up over the equator, in an east-west position, roughly parallel to Calgary.
We should credit BCIT with that last graphic. As I explained earlier, our production facilities were in Burnaby, and the television and the voice signals were transmitted via satellite to Northern Lights College in Dawson Creek and to cable systems in three other college regions: North Island College at Campbell River, Fraser Valley College at Chilliwack, and Okanagan College in Kelowna. In addition, a receive-only Earth station, they could see us and hear us, but they couldn't talk, was located at the British Columbia Forest Products Camp at Pitt Lake, where communications are dependent on radio telephone, and they use the radio telephone to talk back to us. At all sites excluding Pitt Lake, there were community animators whose task was to identify the target audiences, handle local publicity, and manage the interaction with the PEMC studio. Now, it's hard to recreate the sort of general panic with which we started this program, because we really didn't have any experience in this technology, and people kept driving up with Earth stations and leaving them in our backyard, and we kept mounting Earth stations, which we were not familiar with, on various buildings around the province. And people kept telling us that NASA, with whom we share the satellite, you know, was using it today, and that they were doing another launch, and that they weren't around to back us up, and we were rather lost in all this. And it certainly showed in our very original attempt to use this system. And I want you to join host animator Dr. Catherine Carolyn, my apologies, Catherine, for showing this, as we stage our first ever attempt at space-age television. The Earth stations are in place, all the animators are on hand, and the cameras are rolling and recording.
Hi, everybody. I'm Pat Kearney, the manager of the STEP Tele-Education Program. STEP stands just for that, Satellite Tele-Education Program. And today, we're here in the Provincial Media Center Studios, Provincial Educational Media Center Studios at BCIT, for what is really a technical debugging and debriefing session of our program. We've never done this before, and neither have you, and so we're all going to learn lots about this all together. Now, you have the advantage on us because you can see us, and we can't see you. So, starting from north to south, will you introduce yourselves and tell us who is with you? First of all, in Dawson Creek, I hope Dee sat's there. Dee? Where is Dawson Creek? What about Kelowna? We phoned you and you were You answered, so you should be online. Can anybody hear Kelowna? Chilliwack? What about Campbell River? I would say we're in trouble. Can you tell the animators what the problem was?
The problem was very simple. Round Brown in the trailer hadn't switched the system over to us, and we didn't know it and just carried on.
Well, we don't even know if you're there now, which is going to be a normal broadcast event. But what I would like to do is we're going to go to black shortly, and then I am going to do the intro again. Hi, everybody. This is Pat Carney with Catherine. And then I'm going to ask each of you to come on. And I think that it's been explained to you that the crew are going to do all the technical things like voice levels in your intro. So you need to talk for maybe 30 seconds, and maybe you want to tell us what some of your problems were. We can practice with this until we get the hang of it. But are you ready to cut out and do it again? Okay, one more time. Hello, everybody. It's Pat Carney, and we're opening our second teleconference. With me today is Catherine Carolyn of PEMC. And on our warm-up today, we're going to bring in each station in alphabetical order. Is it, Catherine?
Right. Yeah.
And so, John, are you there in Campbell River? John? Where's Nobody
John?
In?
Where's John?
Anybody? Is there anybody in Campbell River?
Away, can you hear me yet?
Yes, we can. Is that John?
Yes, this is me. I've been trying for a few seconds. Is it coming through now?
It's coming through beautifully. Can you talk to us for 30 seconds?
Yes, a very quick one for 30 seconds then. It's good to see you both after having to go all the way down to Vancouver. This is much, much easier. Long may it continue. Good enough?
That's wonderful. Let's try alphabetical order is Chilliwack. Ron Gray, are you in Chilliwack?
Yes, Pat, we're here. We're hearing you, although your audio signal is coming to us a little lower, quite a bit lower than the introductory music was.
You're coming through to us very faintly. Is there any technical advice at this time? Is Daryl here to give? What do you want them to do in Chilliwack?
Pat, I've just picked up the microphone and brought it a lot closer to me. Maybe that's made a significant difference.
Yes, it has. You're coming through, not as loudly as Cabo River, but pretty well. Catherine, who's next?
Next is Dee from Dawson Creek.
Okay, we're here. We also got the music very, very loud, and when you come through, there's a lot of static when we're listening to you.
Okay. I wonder if, I hope your Daryl is taking notes on this because I certainly can't resolve that.
Okay.
And the last station is Kelowna.
Kelowna. Jim Grindley. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Pat. We just lost the visual when I flicked that button. I wonder if it had anything to do with it. Hang on. No, we've lost vision. Oh, you're back. You're back and your audio level is down as well from the last broadcast. There's also a bit of hiss in the background. Definitely not as powerful a signal.
So we call that sequence stumble bum television. Another innovative aspect of the BC experiment was the number and the range of participating agencies. The response from the province's educational and health institutions to the challenge of Hermes was truly phenomenal. The opportunity to access Hermes did not arise until late June. Yet 3 months and 2 days later, we launched a tele-education experiment which involved more than 24 separate agencies. And in comparison, Memorial University, which did fewer hours than us in black and white, took 3 years to plan what we did in 3 months. In addition to those already mentioned, they included the province's three universities, BCIT, the Pacific Vocational College, Vancouver General Hospital, the Provincial Arthritis, Heart, and Diabetic Association, the United Nations Agency Vision Habitat, the National Film Board, the Legal Services Commission, the Greater Vancouver Library Federation, and the BC Forest Service. Other colleges, such as Malaspina, Douglas, and New Caledonia, contributed programming material, administrative services, and evaluation services. And I'm sure I've still left people out. The project sponsor was the Distance Education Planning Group, whose members were seconded from the various departments of the Ministry of Education. Now, all of the participants lacked staff, money, and time, yet nobody refused the opportunity to acquire this hands-on training in satellite communications technology. The major obstacle, the major objective of STEP, and the obstacle, I suppose, was a technical one, as you can see. What we wanted to do on Hermes was to learn how to use the system. We worry about teaching with the system later. We can't develop the educational programming until we learn how to handle the mechanics of it. So only two of the programs had specific teaching objectives, and we'll show you examples of those. On other programs, we tested various program formats, which we will view in the next few sequences. Now, I'm sure you can appreciate the difficulty of picking 2 and 3 minute items out of 64 hours of broadcasting, but we are going to try and show you some of the different techniques tested. The key to this technology is the interaction. It permits the lecturer and the students to communicate face-to-face, but at a distance. Our system employed one-way video from our studio and two-way audio. Our viewers could see us, but we could only hear them. Other systems use two-way video. Our first segment was produced by the UBC Biomedical Unit, and it illustrates the medical grand rounds format. And some of the most exciting things being used in this technology is in the field of telemedicine. Experts from the VGH discussed new advances in the treatment of facial paralysis, and then they discussed the specifics with doctors at our test sites. And this experiment revealed one problem we hadn't anticipated, and that's the need for patient privacy. But Department of Communications is working on scramblers, which we may be able to use in the future. Okay, the VGH.
I'd like to ask now for questions from Dawson Creek, please.
Yes, could you tell us what you mean by early decompression? Presumably this patient is placed on the appropriate steroids. How long does one wait before he sends her down?
Well, if there is a total paralysis, then we do the electrodiagnostic studies. And if the electrodiagnostic studies indicate nerve degeneration, then we go ahead with the decompression. The earliest that electrodiagnostic studies will show this is 48 hours, and they usually will show it within a week. So an early decompression would be one that is done within a week, or certainly within 2 or 3. If the paralysis is persistent for longer than 3 weeks, then we must presume that there is significant nerve degeneration, and that patient will probably never have a complete recovery of function. They will recover, but they will not recover as completely.
Would you suggest then that all patients from a remote area like this be sent down within three days to 1 week for these studies?
No, I think that we would be more anxious to see them all started on steroids immediately, and with the help of a physiotherapist, a simple nerve excitability test could be performed in Dawson Creek, and I'm sure that you could handle this situation and then only have to send those people who are degenerating.
Thank you.
From Kelowna, do we have a question?
One of the doctors who participated in that program in the field reported afterwards that it would have taken him 3 days to come to Vancouver to learn what he learned in that 1 hour program. So we think there's a future for that. Very early in the experiment, we learned that interactive television is not broadcast television. The participants want to discuss the subject matter. They're not willing to sit still for 20 to 30 minutes of one-way television. And this is particularly true of the community education programs aimed at a general audience. So one format developed by UBC and the BC Heart Foundation was the soap opera. Doctors Nancy Swartz and Fred Bass in this segment supply a little soap and a lecture.
Here, take a vitamin pill.
A vitamin pill? What's that gonna do?
It's good for you. Let me get my wine.
Super B complex with liver and iron. Wipes out the effects of alcohol. Keep drinking like that, you're going to need a lot of these, maybe one with every sip. You know what? I understand that you have vitamins and that one can get vitamins in food. And those are the kind of vitamins I'd like to get.
You want bacon and egg vitamins, don't you? Just what your body needs. Have another cigarette. Go right ahead. I'll drink my wine, you smoke your cigarettes.
Listen, you're going to turn into an alky if you keep that up. That is bad news, and that is trouble.
I've had enough. If you'll excuse me, I think I will leave.
Goodbye.
First of all, I should tell you that Fred and Nancy are not really a married couple. They happen to be our panel tonight. And immediately on my left, I have Dr. Nancy Swartz. I've got to read this out. She's got a complicated title. She's a nutritionist at the School of Home Economics, Division of Human Nutrition at UBC. And on her left, we have Dr. Fred Bass, who's with the Vancouver City Health Department, Director of the Lifestyle Program, Medical Officer for the Burrard Health Unit. I might say that they're both extremely fit.
I think all of these lifestyle risk factors have something to do, a lot to do with adolescence. One starts smoking early in adolescence, one starts drinking behavior, and a lot of the eating behavior and exercise behavior becomes firm at that time. And we develop patterns of this kind very much because of what our peers do, or adolescents do, what their peers do. And they also do what feels good. And what determines behavior of adolescents or of us older folks is not so much what we know, but what feels good. And I think health educators have a very tough match in the marketing people and the advertising people and matching their ability to present the products that go along with unhealthy lifestyles. We have a hard time making it seem as feeling good as they do, but we're catching up to them.
In that programming format, they would run, say, 6 to 8 minutes of the soap, and then they would have a period of taking questions where people would phone in either from their home or from the test communities and ask questions of the panel who would respond to them. And then we'd run another soap, and it seems to work quite well. The University of Victoria developed 5 programs, and they were experimenting with various community development techniques, because one of the most critical problems which emerged from STEP was the desire of people to access the system. They want to flick the switch and talk to the person on the screen. And if they can't talk, they become very frustrated and even angry. In this segment, the University of Victoria team is suggesting ways in which viewing participants can prioritize or group their questions. And in this case, the discussion continued for hours after Step went off the air.
That concludes the material that we wanted to present today. And now we're hoping that you will become more actively involved with us in thinking through what implications seem to flow from what we've learned about self-help groups. For the next 20 minutes, you will have the opportunity to develop some questions for the phone-in portion of the program, and your animators have developed a discussion technique to help you with this process. In the meantime, though, let me suggest some of the things which might occur to you in your group discussion. For example, you might wish to share some of your own experience with self-help groups. Or you might like to know more about the kinds of personal problems which seem best suited to self-help group activity. Or you may wish to challenge something that I or the other panelists have said. Or your interest may be in knowing how professionals, doctors, nurses, social workers, can make best use of self-help groups. You could want to discuss how to locate a self-help group and what to expect at your first meeting. You may even want some suggestions on how to start a particular kind of self-help group. Please feel free to call us with any questions, comments, or contradictions. All will be welcome, because there's much to learn about this important people resource.
That message was intended for audiences who've been brought together with an animator in a community hall or a community college. For our home audience, we'll be showing a short film, which will begin in a few moments. So please stand by for that film. And for audiences brought together with animators, if you'll turn down the sound on your monitor, we'll try not to interfere with your discussion. Thank you.
One of the advantages of satellite transmission is the equity inherent in the system. Because for some communication systems, the cost of delivering education increases with distance. This is true in the case of, say, microwave systems or telephone lines. But the cost of transmission via Earth satellite and Earth station, satellite and Earth station, is the same at Dawson Creek as Chilliwack, because you know, you just take your Earth station and park it anywhere that you want, and the satellite picks up the signal. The signal's picked up from the satellite. This is particularly important in BC, where most of the major educational institutions are centralized in the lower mainland Victoria area, while half the population resides in the hinterland. Similarly, the system can be accessed by anyone, anywhere, on an equal basis. In the next segment, we'll illustrate demand programming. Viewers at the test sites ask for and receive specific programming material on request. And in the future, we'll be enjoying demand programming on our own television sets in our own homes. George, where are you?
Show them to you. I'll usually read the catalog description just to give our people in the control room a little bit of time to set them up, and we hope that we'll be able to generate some questions or comments about this way of learning science or different kinds of areas like that from the films. I have two announcements about the list I provided you with before I ask you for your first choices. There's a film called Earth-Sun Relationships, which we weren't able to get this morning. It's probably out on loan somewhere, so that's not on the list. And we have another film which is not on your list. It's a discussion between David Suzuki and some students about genetics, specifically things like genetic programming and cloning, that kind of thing. So if you're interested in seeing a little, these are only clips, you know, perhaps 2 or 3 minutes from these films, but there's a Suzuki film on genetic programming, which is also available. So I think I'll start with Jim Grindley in Kelowna. Dawson Creek is not receiving us as yet, and Campbell River is in a not particularly satisfactory way, but we hope things will get better.
Okay, Catherine, oh. Kelowna's first vote was living in space.
Okay, living in space. Let me find that on my sheet here.
It's VLS 11A.
Thank you. VLS-11A, Living in Space. This comes from NASA. It's the total film is 8 minutes in color, and the catalog says it's suitable for intermediate school or secondary school. And this is the description: life support and routine activities in space. So we'll go ahead and watch that now. Thanks, Jim.
In outer space, there is no air to breathe, no water, no food. When man travels out there, he must take with him everything he needs, and that is one of the problems of space travel. Consider the question of a livable atmosphere. In space, there's an almost perfect vacuum. Near the moon, for instance, pressure is so low that a molecule of gas can travel 30 million miles before it hits another molecule. At sea level on Earth, it could barely move before colliding. The fact that such a hard vacuum exists is one of the reasons for going there. It presents a chance to conduct experiments and do scientific work in an atmosphere different from ours. But to do such work, we have to take our atmosphere with us.
I'm sure you can realize the exciting potential of that random access, as we call it, demand programming, for teachers who are in isolated parts of BC and who want simply to find out what's available from a central library. I said earlier that only two-step programs had specific educational objectives, and they are two of our favorites. One was produced by BCIT, which made a major contribution to STEP, producing 8 programs on forestry alone. This first segment employs a simulation program format. Now, the participants in this experiment were the loggers at Pitt Lake who could only talk to us on the radio phone. If it's hard to hear the talkback, it's because it's on the radio phone. And there were also BC Forest Service personnel at the other test sites, and there was a simulation crew at our studio. And as you'll hear on this tape, the loggers were sitting in the community hall. They were seeing a simulated forest fire on the screen, and then they were directing the forest fire fighting themselves. And then at the other test sites, they were critiquing this and arguing about whether or not they should have sent the water bombers in further or whether they had enough hose. And it was extremely exciting, and I wish we could show you the whole half hour. It's because it's got a very exciting potential for training forest fire fighters around the province. Watch closely as animators Ron Gray and Catherine Carolyn explain the process again to you.
Tell me more about it. I really didn't understand it.
Well, they had a picture of the forest, and they were projecting the visual images onto it. In the meantime, in the background, they were generating the sound effects of the helicopters water bomber planes and chainsaws.
And loggers from Pitt Lake were...
Loggers at Pitt Lake were actually running, giving the kind of orders they would give, and then they were making the changes in what they projected on the scene so that it seemed like you were seeing, as from an airplane, really, what kind of fire effect was going on.
Yeah.
It was tremendously exciting, and they really did a good job on them.
Yeah, Roger, as soon as you complete that second trip, with those other two fellas and that 1,500 feet of hose, I would appreciate it if you could fly back down above the fire to the eastern direction on the low side of the road, and by that time we should have that 12-man crummy up there, the tank truck, and some more hose.
Roger, got that.
Make a meet with you there, and it looks like what we'll do is transport 2 more men to the top side, and as much hose as you can pack.
Roger. Hey, Ross, this is ED-26, over.
Roger, go ahead.
We're just unloading the helicopter now. We can see the fire is spreading out under the trees on both sides of the road in the slash, over.
Roger, how warm do you figure it's going to be? Give me 5 minutes, Al. What's it look like?
Could I get a repeat on that, fire boss?
How are we going to be looking in 5 minutes from now?
It seems to be hesitating at the edge of the wide open slash, but it's fairly dry down here, and I think we should try and get on as soon as we can. Over.
Yeah, Roger. I don't know if you got that transmission. We're going back to dispatch. You'll have two fellows joining you shortly, another 1,500 feet of hose. That'll give you a total of 3,000, two pumps. And he's going to make a return trip in our direction to the east. And by that time, we should have that 12-man, the tanker there, and we'll get you up by another 2,000, 3,000 feet of hose. That should put you to the edge of the fire from the creek.
Roger, fire boss. This creek looks like it can use a little bit of work before we can pump out of it, so I think that's probably what we'll be doing right off the bat. Over.
Roger, give us room for two pumps.
Roger on that.
At the end, they had the BCIT people had the Pit Lake people graded on how they did managing the fire.
Well, and in, from all of the participating stations around the network, there were local firefighting experts who kind of gave them their report card.
And they were hard.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job, but those experts were really, really rough on them.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Up till then, we'd already learned that our satellite teleprogramming in Pit Lake did not compete with porno movies. But in the case of the simulation, they just thought that was tremendous. The aim of every educational television producer is to create a program which is both instructional and entertaining. And one example is the segment where librarians Trish Labonte of BCIT and Peter Simmons of UBC are teaching librarians at the test sites how to use computers to do online searching. Now, the mechanics of this escape me, but in general, we had computer terminals at our Burnaby studio and also out at our test sites. And these terminals were linked directly to UBC's computer and indirectly to computers in California and Montreal. The librarians had already received a print manual prepared by Trish, who incidentally has never taught before. Here, Trish and Peter are teaching people who don't have access to this kind of instruction in their home communities and would normally have to come to the Lower Mainland to receive it.
The way I'd like to structure this program is to use LibCon first, use the actual LibCon file that we've discussed and you've read about in your manuals. By the way, did everybody have a chance to go through the, okay, Lillian, there's your cue. How about trying the E again?
Come on, Lillian.
Well done. Okay, now Lillian, just use your backspace key, backspace one. Right. Now, type in SDC. Good work. Now, our password is orbit. You just type in the word orbit. And carriage return. Good. Okay. Now, the next thing is our actual logon, our actual identifier. Now, strangely enough, that's our cue. That semicolon is our cue to go further. SDC has recognized us. Now, we have to identify to SDC that we are verified, we're legitimate users. So now you type in the whole word, slash login, space, and your CDN password.
Excuse me, Trish, this is Kelowna. Could I just interrupt?
Sure.
Are we supposed to be dialed in as well?
Yeah, can you see this on your screen?
Perhaps we should take some time to check and make sure that everybody can.
Okay. Great. Okay. Brilliant. That was a super job. Really well done. Kelowna, you're having trouble now. Can you see on the screen what you can see on your video screen? Can you see that on your terminal?
Yeah. Okay. It's all right.
Okay. Now, what we will do is only one person, because SDC is identifying us as one user, Only one person at a time will have an opportunity to actually put their hands on the terminal and go through the next stage. I think we found this morning that people were anxious to get ahead, and we were all jumping in and messing up the signal for each one of us. If it's at all possible, I'd like to take the queuing on this so that everybody gets a fairly good chance to try using the system. So at this point, since Kelowna has already got us through the login and actually did an excellent job on it, there are no problems whatsoever, I'd like to suggest now that we attempt to go into the LibCon file. And Kelowna, perhaps you'd like to take this responsibility. How's that sound?
I could watch that program all day. Of course, the librarians at the other test sites could see everything that we saw, and also, of course, had the terminals that they used too. And that program was produced towards the end of our experiment, and I think you'll agree that we'd come a long way from our opener. We've illustrated in this section a variety of programming formats, which we developed for Hermes, and we have some idea from them of which you could use for educational programming using interactive satellite systems. But I'd like to just summarize some of the things we learned. First, we learned that the geographical area which we can access via satellite is enormous. For instance, our footprint covers South America, so our forest fire simulation could have been transmitted to loggers in South America as easily as to our loggers in Pitt Lake. And second, we learned that we could hook up just about everything short of the kitchen sink, possibly because we didn't try that. On this segment, with Laurier Lapierre and Patrick Watson, illustrates the geographical range of the system.
Something's just happened which has not happened before on the satellite, and that is that we have a phone call coming in to our studios. Will you accept it?
No, I have nothing to do with it.
Okay, fine.
I am putting, right, madam, in your hands.
All right, we're ready.
Laurier, this is Patrick. What? And I'm calling you from the satellite control center on the banks of the Ottawa River here, where I've been sitting watching you 2,500 miles away with this fascinating educational experiment.
It's 1 o'clock.
And I want to ask you a question, if I may.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you're talking in your speech about the powers that Ottawa must have, that a federal government must have, in order to distribute the goods and services of this country with some equity.
Yes.
In the different regions of Canada. And yet I had on the Watson Report a couple of weeks ago, Pierre Debanay, who you know, who represents a very poor region of Quebec, and who said unequivocally that there is no political will in...
spends over $1 billion a year of federal tax money in order to develop various economic sectors in the areas, the underprivileged areas.
No, George, can you override that? Laurier is doing something there which Mildred Jeffrey, who's in the office, and the audience and I are familiar with, and that is that because you can't see the voice, you're inclined to look at the God in the heavens and, you know, behind the chairs to find out where the voices are coming from. We also learned that this technology will have enormous social impact. It will change our perceptions of distance. For one of the American experimenters said that the day that Hermes was launched was the day that distance died. And it will change our perceptions of ourselves. And in this segment, McGill history professor and broadcaster Laurier Lapierre, who's been savaged by a viewer in Kelowna for his views in bilingualism, says it best, as Laurier usually does. Now, we ran over a segment, and I'm hoping that George can come up with this one. George? Cabo River? So I'm just going to ask him, because we can't go on to the next tape. Okay. Thanks. It should be coming up right now.
Who's almost, 2,500 miles away, from what I am, an instantaneous sort of thing. And you mean to tell me that the old French language is a problem of unity? Now, come on. Surely what people must understand is that we are now reaching the time where we now possess the technology to be able to instantaneously put people in communications with each other and instantaneously translate their thought in a considerable number of languages, so that the whole hang-up, madam, of your generation, which is also the hang-up of my generation, since we are both of the same generation, is no longer valid. Is no longer valid. We are now being completely changed in our attitude by the impact of technology.
We've also learned that this particular technology is not a barrier to the participants. It just seems to fade away. The participants talk to each other in their space-age classroom as easily as they do in a campus lecture hall. And in this segment from our Satellite College series, a UBC anthropologist answers a question from Campbell River, is corrected by a participant in Kelowna, who's asked for further information by Campbell River. It's a very moving sequence, too.
Campbell River, any questions? We haven't heard from you yet tonight. John?
Yes, Catherine, this is columnist Gavin Campbell River.
Oh, hello,
pinch-hitting for John tonight. He had a previous long-standing appointment. And yes, we do have a number of questions. I'd like to say, first of all, if I may, that I have here with me a couple of my anthropology students who are enrolled in an open university course in anthropology, Sharon Ballard and Brenda Belfleur.
Right.
And we do have a couple of questions.
Go ahead.
One of the first ones I might have, it relates to some of the things that were just being said, especially regarding language. I'm just wondering if you've ever run across anyone in this area who, in fact, can still communicate with animals.
In terms of talking to the animals, no. Certain songs, for instance, are still family property throughout the province, claim to have been given by animals, but I haven't ever run into anyone who claims to be able to communicate. That doesn't mean that that there aren't people who do. Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting. Kelowna here. We have a representative of the Indian Friendship Society who says that she is able to communicate with animals, and I'm going to turn you over to her.
I am Stella. I am Danae. It's difficult to talk about communicating with the animals in the world that you live in, because of all the influences coming from outside. Among the traditional people, communicating with animals, with your environment, is a total circle, and that within the circle, everyone is equal. The animals have spirits, the environment, the total environment, the water, the trees, the leaves, the insects, everybody's got a spirit and a place in the society, in the natural world. And all the traditional people believe in this spiritual thing, so that when you do believe in this, you understand all these things.
Thanks for that super contribution. Does that help you in Campbell River?
Yes, it certainly does. I'm absolutely delighted with the kinds of things that this system can give us, and I'd certainly like to ask the people in Kelowna to send me the name of the lady, if they could, up here in Campbell River sometime. I rather missed that. I have another question.
Finally, we learned something of the power of this system in terms of communicating emotions and feelings. Our final program segment combines a portion of a PEMC film on scientist David Suzuki and his family, who represent four generations of Canadians. This film describes his rage at their evacuation from the coast during the Second World War, and it concludes with an interactive exchange between David and his viewers.
Hi, I'm Carl Suzuki, born in Vancouver 68 years ago. And I'm second generation Japanese, we call Nisei. And my son David is 41 years of age, and he was born in Vancouver. And he's called the Sansei, third generation. And my grandson Troy is the fourth generation, born in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He's 15 years of age, and he's called the Yonsei, which means, which, as I said, is fourth generation.
When I was younger, I never thought of myself as being other than Canadian, straight Canadian. And it was only much later, as I began to realize what had happened during the evacuation to me and my people, that I realized that I will always be a Japanese Canadian in the eyes of other people. The definitive and most important event in Japanese Canadian history was the evacuation.
I may change my mind.
The evacuation hit when I was 5 years old. We moved to Slocan City in 1942 and stayed there till 45. And as a child at that age, I don't think we're really aware in any real way of what the hell's going on. One day my father's in Vancouver, the next day he's gone. A few weeks later, my mother and my sisters and I are on a train heading off for the interior of British Columbia. I wasn't even aware that all of the people on the train were Japanese.
Let's move on to Chilliwack. Ron, Gray, any questions?
We have one questioner here just before he comes to the microphone. David, I wanted to mention that I was six when they did that to you, and I've felt ever since then that I've wanted to apologize to somebody for it. I guess you and your dad are the people I'll apologize to. We have a questioner here.
Hello? I was wondering about what time, like when you came over to Canada, when you came over from Japan.
Well, you see, that's the whole point, I think, of the program. Both my father and I were born in this country. We never came over. We are Canadians.
Maybe he's asking when Mr. Suzuki's father came over. Or
when my father came, well, that'll be over 70 years ago. My father came to this country as an immigrant.
To Vancouver, or is that where he
came
first?
Yes, to Steveston.
Yeah. Right.
And he apprenticed as a fisherman. And he, of course, he was a carpenter from Japan, so he was able to work building boats and things like that.
Right.
So then,
I want a Chilliwack question.
Sorry, I wanted to say something to the Chilliwack person, because, you know, I feel very moved that someone feels the need to apologize. You see, I don't think the apology is necessary. It's not that they did it to us, it's that we did it to us. And I think the important thing about the evacuation is that it should be a tremendous lesson to us that democracy is a very, very difficult ideal to live up to. And if the Japanese have ever made a contribution to Canada, I think it should be simply as a lesson that in times of stress, people can do very bad things. But the important thing is not to say, well, I'm sorry, we shouldn't have done. Let's just never do it again.
In summary, possibly the most important aspect of Hermes was that more than 500 people in the BC educational system were able to participate in the production end of this satellite tele-education project. We were never able to number our viewers because we couldn't monitor how many were watching us on our cable systems. But it seems a fair assessment to say that BC probably has more educators with hands-on experience in this technology than in all the other provinces combined. We learned that satellite telecommunications must be used very selectively, and now we want to know if we can utilize this technology in a distance education system, which also encompasses print and video and audio tapes and libraries and computers and face-to-face instruction. And we have applied for a 2-year tele-education slot on Anik B, the next satellite, which will be launched this fall. And that's the satellite on which we will test educational programming. The final word belongs to the Minister of Education, Dr. Pat McGeer. Thank you. This is the last tape.
Do you want to have another question? And then we'll move on.
Yes, I feel we do. Mr. Springsteen, did you have a question?
Kelowna, that's not like you not to have a question right on hand.
Dr. McGeer, this is highly sophisticated, and I must say it's a first in my life. Do you feel that, and this I'm not aware of, that the costs of this are going to be reasonable for the specific purpose of remote education? I realize that this is a technical problem and a very regional problem. Are the costs going to be within reason?
Yes, compared with what we already spend in other forms of education, and what we already spend in other forms of television, the fantastic amounts of money, for example, that go into the CBC, if we could just take a small part of that and channel it into education, we might get far better cost benefit. So really, our view is that the cost of this is going to be cheap. One of the things that was discovered by the Open University in Britain, which I just visited this past week, it uses television extensively, including television production. It uses radio and radio cassettes. It uses experimental kits that are mailed out so people can do their laboratory experiments in their home. It uses extensive print materials. It uses tutors. It uses people that are brought together 1 week a year for face-to-face lectures in a college. It has assignments that move back and forth between the main Open University by mail and the students who are out there in the system. With all of these things, the overall cost per student is half a regular university. So you see, we can do a tremendous amount in the way of bringing education right to you in your home and do it cheaper than the systems that we're now using. So the answer to your question is an unqualified yes.
Okay. We can take, I'll take any questions if you want.
Well, as is customary, and without wishing to deny the minister the last word, the Institute audience may wish to ask some questions. So are there any questions for Ms. Carney? Yes.
Ms. Carney, as director of this project, you are undoubtedly convinced that it's very worthwhile in terms of the technology. But you are also an economist. To what extent do you really believe as an economist, considering that BC has a population of 2.25 million, that it is possible to deliver these programs reasonably in comparison with Britain, which has 55 million?
Okay. I should explain that I didn't know how appropriate some of these comments would be given the time of February the 18th. So I really can't talk on the Open U aspect of it. I don't know. I haven't been involved in that part of it. in terms of the satellite program, the expectations and the forecasts are, is yes, it's going to be, as the technological, as the Earth stations get smaller, it is going to be an economically cost-effective way of transmitting that kind of programming. And for instance, our entire STEP program on the 64 hours of broadcasting, it, by the time everybody added up all their costs, it was less than $80,000, which that's not a true cost in the sense that most people were working overtime and also doing other jobs, but it was not a mammothly, you know, massively expensive project. And to get 64 hours of experimental time for $80,000, I think is, as an economist, I think is quite worthwhile. On Annex B, we'll know more about the costs of doing it in terms of teaching.
In view of the fact that the many subjects are involved in this satellite, health, medical care, education, and so on, it's like splitting a dam whose cost between irrigation and power and this sort of thing. How much part of this cost is going to be attributed to education? The type of thing that you have in mind here. The medical profession, I imagine, was very happy with this. And in fact, wouldn't mind having the health department in Victoria pay part of the cost.
Well,
would you repeat the question?
Oh, I'll say. Our questioner would like to know how much of the cost would be borne by education and how much by other users. Well, I think it would depend on the user, if I heard your question. The American experiments have indicated that it's not cost which is the barrier to this technology. It is the way our society is organized. For instance, in the American medical experiments, the participating hospitals thought that this was a fantastic technology until they found that their referrals were being cut by something like 65% and their consulting fees were being affected at their end. And that, you know, if you can't have a fee for service type of medicine and use the satellite unless you share the costs around more. So it's who pays and how. You know, that have to be overcome before we can use the technology. It's not the technology, and it's not going to be the costs of the delivered signal. It's going to be on the way we add up our dollars and divide our dollars. Cerny? Go ahead.
Have you experimented with the delivery of classical lecture and ordinary lecture?
Yes, we've done, we did what we called, the question was, have we experimented with people talking as in a lecture room? Yes. Carleton and Stanford conducted a joint experiment with professors in each university in a very esoteric subject, which I don't even remember the name of. And the Stanford professor gave his lecture, and the Ottawa students sat in their classroom and watched it and talked to him by hitting a switch in their chair. And when the lecturer, I saw one example of a lecturer who was discussing the design of a dental clinic, and as he drew and sketched on the blueprints in front of him on the podium, it was being shown to his classroom on an overhead projector and to his satellite classroom just as he sketched it. There doesn't seem to be a barrier. And as I said earlier, in the normal model of educational programming, yes, the talking head can be very boring. But we found that if you have a David Suzuki or a Laurier Lapierre or a good anthropology lecturer who's a good professor anyway, and there is time to interact, that the technology just goes away. You're not aware. You're no longer aware that the person you're talking to is, you know, hundreds of miles away.
Isn't it true, though, Pat, that both of those people you just mentioned are professional broadcasters?
they were academics before they be. They said. Yeah. The question is, so the point is that teachers have to be trained in the media?
Yes, I'm wondering, oh, yeah. Do you have any ideas? Are you planning perhaps
to
do a training?
Oh, yes, I think so, yeah. The question is that is the education department interested in training people in these skills? And I think the answer would have to be yes. But, you know, I'm not going to give up my basic point. A boring lecture is a boring lecture in this classroom or on satellite television. I've sat through in many boring lectures and and some very good ones. And a man and a woman who is a good professor and communicates with his class has no trouble doing it in this medium. The question is, would we be doing our own programming, or would we be importing it in this mode? Well, again, I can't tell you what Dr. McGeer is going to do with the Open University, but I do know that there is so much to do in this field that we could keep all our own production facilities operating around the clock, like at BCIT and at PEMC, just developing material for people in BC who want that kind of information, whether it's a vocational course or an academic course or a career course. The question is, would be as short as a program development? I'm sure that it depends, I suppose, on how much you wanted to go into this in the beginning, and that is a subject for the minister, not for me. I don't know what he is actually planning to do and how quickly. But I do know that, you know, you could take the best of the Open U and the best of University of Mid-America or some of the other American colleges and the best of OECA and the best that Access is doing and all of the other, you know, this is not a new technology, educational programming. You could take the best programs around and you still wouldn't be able to fill the demand in BC that we feel is there for educational programming. And the whole field of vocational and career distance learning using television is not being touched by anybody, and that's a very exciting field. Just one of my favorite stories on that is that people have told us in this experiment that you cannot teach vocational or anything with a hands-on component, medicine, civil engineering, or anything like that, using television, because they say the person has to come and at some point in time, you know, put his hands on the scalpel or whatever. And of course the point is, yes, that's true, but the question is, how much hands-on do you need? And one of my favorite experiences with Hermes was when the people in Chilliwack reported that the only man in town who knew how to turn off the satellite system had left for the day, and they didn't know what to do. And our supervisor, technical supervisor, came on the studio with the equipment and said, well, you know, turn it around, can you see this and can you see that? And Chilliwack said, yeah. And he says, well, you disengage this and you pull out that, and he shut down the system. Yeah, so.
Something like that with more than one channel, I suppose it does, so that you can get medical programs and curricula of all kinds
of. Oh, yes, the question is if there's more than one channel. Yes, Hermes, I think, has something like 2 television channels and 1,200 voice channels. And, you know, what I personally, technically, am interested in is whether we could network, like if you were a geologist in, say, the Prince George country, could you have, just radio, voice signal, earth stations, and communicate with Prince George, and then link into UBC and the geology department using the video. This tremendous range. And in the medical experiments, they have learned how to divide up, I wish I knew more about the technical aspect, but they've learned how to divide up the television channel to ship four television programs down it. They just, apparently it's a question of bits that they transmit. Well, they just divide the bits up into four programs, and that means the color isn't quite as clear, but it's quite adequate. Yes, they're doing incredible things. NASA now has a little bus. And in the front of the bus, there's a driver. And on the top, there's an earth station. And in the back, there's a little studio. And they can run around any place that you can take or barge or ship a bus and transmit and receive the signal. So that's why I'm interested in it for BC, where you can't build microwaves into every mining camp and every new town and every coal community. Yes?
Sir?
The question is whether it's been proven that people learn from the system, learn using television. Again, I can only tell you what the other people in the system have learned, which is, because we don't do it yet, which is that either there's no difference or people learn at least as well in a television mode, linked with everything else as they do in a classroom. But it's, you know, you're talking about a different audience. Your distance learner is a person who, for some reason, isn't in the classroom. He either can't get here or, like some of the students in the college system, just can't conceive of coming to, say, a university. Anybody who can get to a college or get to a university or get to BCIT, you can assume is going to try and get there. You're only servicing the people who, because they're working or they're living in Prince George with a mortgage and a wife and three kids, can't access it. And they're motivated. I know Memorial teaches on television, with television, and they have a captive audience. If you want to get you're teaching credentials in Newfoundland, you either do it this way or you don't do it at all. And so they do it. The question is, what is the cost of a television, of a voice channel on the satellite vis-a-vis long distance telephone call? And I can't answer that because we don't have an operational commercial in the sense that we can access it satellite. But it would have to be competitive, or else there would be no users. I mean, nobody would be interested in it if it wasn't competitive. There are enormous, I mean, now when you use a long-distance telephone, you're probably using a satellite. These are intermodal systems, or whatever other fancy word you want to use.
Can you tell us anything about Polaris Carbon Sky that agrees about
Canada and the United States? Okay, thanks. So can I put that on hold? Because I have a tape on that. And this gentleman has been jumping up and down.
I wonder how far away you think we are now from having interactive systems with TV in both directions, and from your experience, how important do you think that would be?
Okay. The question is, how far away are we from having two-way video, and how important is it? Well, there's already two-way video, but the experimenters have learned that there's not much need for it in many cases. It doubles the cost. But for a lot of the things that we were doing, it's just as effective to have the voice feedback. You don't need a very fancy system on this. So again, it depends what you use it for. Yeah, yeah. After you get used to the voices from heaven, and it's just like any other distance learning technique. Anybody, whether they're teaching by telephone or tutoring at a distance, or says that you have to know who your students are. I mean, you have to know that Mrs. Smith is an outport fisherman's wife, and she's got four kids, and she has trouble getting to her classes, etc. And then once you know who your students are, you really don't need to see them. But if I could, I'd like to answer Ian's question. I do have a four-minute tape about from another experiment, not ours, which I'd like to show you, because it shows to me one of the best uses of the satellite, and that is in telemedicine. And this is bootlegged from an experiment conducted by the University of Western Ontario and a settlement on Hudson's Bay called Moose Factory, which is about 700 miles away. And University of Western Ontario conducted 1,100 medical consultations on Hermes using 65 medical specialists. And I saw some of their tapes, and this one features Bartholomew, a native. And his doctor is 700 miles away, and you'll see Bartholomew in black and white. And you'll hear the doctor giving directions to both Bartholomew and the health worker who's manipulating Bartholomew's tummy. And I'd love to show it to you because it's quite different from anything we did, but it shows you the... Yes, I hope so. George, are you there, George? Where's Bartholomew?
Morning, Bartholomew. Lou Carey, I'm down here in London, and we're just going to have a look at your food pipe there and your stomach. Understand you've been having some trouble with your stomach, some burning and digestion not quite right, and so this is a way we have of looking at your stomach. And Mr. Moffat there has had some experience with this sort of examination. He's going to give you a cup with some chalky material in it, and he'll just ask you to swallow this chalky material, and then we'll have a look at your stomach, and I'll be seeing the same thing here as he's seeing there. All right?
All right.
Two good-sized giant swallows there, Bartholomew. Excellent. Push your fingers in and then just hold it and let me see the mucosal pattern. Keep the screen still. That's excellent there. Bartholomew, if you could stop breathing periodically, would you? Okay, if we could have a look at the distal antrum and the pyloroduodenal junction, please, Jim. You'll turn him just very slightly to his left so we can throw the duodenum into relief. That's fine, right there. Now, if you could take one more swallow of barium. put it in view in the screen and sort of press down on it and see if you can compress the walls together with your index finger. It's probably up under his ribs a bit, but that's fine. I'm getting a view of it. Okay, don't see anything so far. I wonder if you would then ask him to take a half a turn to his left and go ahead and finish off the drink, and we'll have a look at his esophagus again in this projection. It was one area we didn't see initially, and we saw it well there. Now, if you just localize over the EG junction, please, Jim. Hey, that's fine. We can tilt the table down now, Jim, if he's finished the drink.
It's Bartholomew. There. I don't know what happened to Bartholomew. I don't know whether he needed surgery or not, but I brought a tape of some of the medical experiments. We'll be here with the medical biomedical unit if anyone wants to see it. They have a wonderful teledentary, a dentist scene where there's a little four-year-old crying his head off, and the dentist is getting instructions on what to do from a dentist 700 miles away. How many more questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we might have three more questions. Yes.
The question is, what educational programs are being offered now? In BC, the only educational programs that are offered in a formal sense on television is the school broadcasts, which are produced by PEMC and the other provinces and shared in the Western region. Am I correct, Jean, that that's... And there are school radio broadcasts, but unlike some of the other provinces, BC has not yet gone into educational television, but we are applying next week to the CRTC to activate the educational channel in the interior.
That